one bill, one to introduce?
That's correct.
We don't have a quorum yet.
Lights are on.
It probably is.
Can we operate without rules? Sure we can.
I'll get you over this way.
Thank you.
Yeah? I'm gonna use five.
We have some organizational business to take care of.
How's it going?
But we don't have a quorum, so we'll move ahead. I'll open an informational meeting and ask Rocky King and whoever he would like to bring forward. You're going to fly solo today?
I'm flying solo today.
Uh-oh.
Okay, it's up.
Good afternoon.
The lights down a little?
Pardon?
You need the lights down a little, or you?
You can see them.
We have those slides too, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go then.
So, good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the executive director for the Oregon's Health Insurance Exchange, now called Cover Oregon. And so I'm here to kind of give you a brief overview of where we are and kind of what we're doing. I want to start first by thanking Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair Thompson, who attended a board meeting, I think, last month. We had representatives from the federal government come out, and the governor came, and it was a really nice opportunity for the federal representatives to meet our legislative leadership, as well as the governor, and for them coming out here to thank us for the work we've done, and for the governor and the legislators to also thank our federal partners for the work they've done to help us get to this point. You can't hear me unless it's real close. Okay. Before I start, I also want to point out our mission, which is not just to bring up an exchange and to provide insurance coverage for Oregonians, but really, ultimately, is to improve the health for all Oregonians. And we want to really look at how over the next few years we begin to focus on the quality and value that we can bring to the healthcare system, and how we can really partner with the Oregon Health Authority in the transformation of the delivery system, again, to improve Oregon citizens' health. This is kind of a mixture of in the weeds as well as general view, because we have some of you that are new, some of you new again, I should say. Representative Widener, welcome. And so I pardon me if I start off at 10,000 feet, and pardon me if I get down into the weeds that maybe is a little more than what you have been seeing, and I'm happy to meet with you individually to give you a better background. But again, we were created by the 2011 legislature, Senate Bill 99. We were formed as a public corporation. It's a key piece of the Affordable Care Act by the federal government, recalling that Oregon, like other states, had the option of either starting their own exchange, or they could opt out and allow the federal government to move forward and have a federal exchange in each of the states. And I should tell you, there are about 35 states who have opted out to allow the federal government to operate their exchange, and 15 to 17, some of those are districts, have opted to have their own exchange. I just got back from Washington, D.C. Last week, and I will tell you, of those 17 that have opted to have their own exchange, I believe that probably half of them will be successful and be able to come out the door on October 1st, 2013. The others, I believe, will end up opting out and having the federal government come in and operate their exchange. Governance, we have a board of directors appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, representing small business, large business, consumers, providers, Dr. Goldberg from the Oregon Health Authority, as well as Lou Savage, the insurance commissioner. We do have a legislative oversight committee, Representative Greenlick, Representative Thompson on the House side, and Senators Boquist and Senator Mona Anderson on the Senate side. They generally meet with our executive staff once a month, and sharing of different issues that either have been brought to their attention or ones that we want to make sure and ask for their counsel or advice about. Okay, this is kind of the opening page where we're starting to develop the what's called the user interface. And so a lot of people say, what are you going to look like? And this is the kind of the opening page that a lot of people will see as they start to come to the exchange. If you haven't been to our website, coveroregon.com, I encourage you to go there. We have a lot of information and background about the work we've been doing. But you are, I guess, really the second group to see this as we work in putting it together. You'll notice that the writing is in Latin because we haven't done all the language yet. We're really just putting all the frames from all the different pages that people are going to see. The exchange serves two groups of folks. First of all, individuals and families, and the second, small businesses. For individuals and families, I'll show you a chart here in a minute that gives us a little bit more detail, but up to 400% of the federal poverty level, there will be financial assistance through tax credits, or if they're under 139% of poverty, the state's Medicaid program. It will be an opportunity for people searching for health insurance and wanting to buy it to shop on an apples-to-apples comparison. Now, sometimes I like to say it's going to be Macintosh versus Gravenstein, and it won't always be just perfectly looking alike because everybody's formulary is a little different. Everybody has a little bit different doctor's network. But generally, you're going to be able to line up and look at benefits that are almost exactly the same. We'll have standardized plans at a variety of different levels that every carrier has to provide information on. There'll be price transparency. You'll not only see the benefit plans, where they're offered, who the docs are, but you can also see then the prices and compare one plan to another. And finally, quality grades. Over that first year, we will be developing a system to provide quality grades to every plan. So a person can say, give me a plan between $300 and $400 that has a quality grade of 4 that's in this geographical area serving this zip code. And we hope to be able to then also do a search by, and is my primary care provider in those plans. You press those buttons and hopefully we can narrow down and bring people right up front on that computer screen the plans that make the most sense to what they're interested in. One of the reasons why this is such a difficult project is you can look at just this eligibility for financial assistance chart and begin to get a picture of it. The left is children from 0 to above 400%. You'll notice for children from 0 to 200%, they have the Healthy Kids Program, a lot of times called CHIP. From 2 to 300% of federal poverty level, there's the Healthy Kids Connect, which is kind of the commercial side of Healthy Kids. From 300 to 400% of federal poverty level, you have children that will be eligible for tax credits. Above 400, it's self-pay. Now, align that against those eligibility categories for adults, and they don't necessarily all line up.
Rocky, what's 400 for a family of four? Just to remind
family you. Of four, I think
about $85,000.
It's $92,200. So on the right hand side, your right hand side, you can see for a family of four in 2013 the approximate FPL levels. But for
I'm the one driving our staff crazy trying to get their lights away. I'm afraid if we shut the lights back there, you'll all fall asleep. Please try and stay awake.
That's okay.
Just so you stay awake, Rocky.
So for adults, now we go up to 139% of federal poverty level for Medicaid. From 139 up to 400%, you'll have tax credits, sliding scale based on your income. And above that 400% of federal poverty level, you are self-pay. Now imagine going in a door where we're going to do your eligibility and send you off to the appropriate program that you can receive the most help for. It is a very complicated process. It will not be totally seamless. I like to say it's seamless with some speed bumps in there. We'll send some kids down one corridor to the kitchen to get CHIP. We'll send some other kids that are self-pay to another place in the house. But it gives you an idea, I think, of just the complexity with which we're having to build this system. These are not our categories. These are categories defined by federal government and the ACA and Medicaid regulations. For small employers, first of all, to get a tax credit and you're a small employer, generally under 25 employees, under 25,000 average salary, I should say that, is it's a little bit farther than that you can, in terms of the size of employees, but the real benefits are for the smaller firms, 10 or less, with very low-wage employees. We'll provide them with more choices. I'll talk to you about this in a few minutes, as well as online tools through the sorting process to help make those kinds of decisions. Employers specifically have four choices coming into the exchange. The first one is called the single plan. You're all familiar with that. If you're an employer, you contact an agent or you call a carrier and say, I would like carrier your plan B. And all my employees will enroll in that plan. That's the only choice they have. I'm going to either pay all of it or a portion of it, but that's the choice. One carrier, one plan. We're going to go a little bit farther, and the market does today, and we're going to say you have a second option, and that is just pick a carrier. Pick Blue Cross, Pacific Source, ODS, Kaiser, whichever carrier you want, as long as they're offering plans through the exchange, and you have the option of taking any plan offered by that carrier. So if Kaiser has three plans, you have your choice of Kaiser, any of those three plans, as an employee. So the employer really is just picking a carrier and letting the employee then pick the plan. And based on the cost of that plan, they may have to make up a little bit more money if it's a richer plan, or it may cover the full cost if it's a less rich plan. The third option that we're putting out there is what we call the metal plans. So decide. If for those of you who are familiar with it, it's the bronze, silver, gold, and platinum levels, and it's all same benefits, but it's different cost sharing. So one of the things you can say as an employer, I'm going to pick the bronze plan or the silver plan, and you have your choice of any carrier that offers that. So to the employee, they're not tied to just the carrier, one carrier. They can say, well, I like Kaiser, or I like ODS, or I like Health Net. They can go to the carrier they may feel the most comfortable with, but it will be the same level of benefit for everybody. The fourth option, and one of the reasons why small business really, I think, supported the exchange, is we're going to come with something that large businesses really have today, but small employers do not have the option of, and that's broad choice. Basically, we're saying, employer, you decide on how much money you want to contribute for health care costs. You give that money to that employee, it'll be going to an account, and that employee can come to the exchange, pick any carrier, any plan, and they have to make up the difference in a price for a plan they choose and what you decide you want to contribute. Now, the nice part about this is it gets the small employer out of having to decide on a carrier or decide on a plan. That really becomes the choice of the employee rather than the employer. So it's a full, what they call, defined contribution. Large employers have had it for years, but for this first time, we're going to be able to provide, I think, this full of an option for small employers. So four options. Timeline, 2013 and beyond. On the left, you'll see February 2013. We're in the really in the phase of deciding all of the kind of the user interface. You saw the page when I showed you one of the web pages. That's called the user interface. We're beginning to really finalize that user interface that all of our customers will see when they go to the website. Those will be done by the end of February. In March, we're going to start training on the system because we'll have a good idea of what its capabilities are and what the user interface will look like. We'll start training some of our stakeholders around that. In April of this year, April 30th, we are done with the IT construction. And, you know, a lot of people are thinking, well, I thought you had till 2014. And the answer to that is no. We really are shooting to finish the IT build on April 30th, 31st this year. The reason for that is we want 3 to 4 or 5 months of testing. Now, imagine 200,000 code lines, and I got three of them wrong. One of them that averages the premium differently than it should be. One of them that drops a child off if you have more than three children. Or the fourth that just doesn't send out renewal notices. I've got to make sure that when this thing comes up, on January 1, 2014, with open enrollment in October, that this works. So we need those 3 to 4 months of what we call user acceptance testing. We will run through hundreds and hundreds of scenarios. We will test out using our calculators, every premium calculation that that machine does. We will have load testing done so that different parts of the state come into that system at the same time and go to the same plans, make sure that we can take 10,000 people inquiring the same day, not just 4,000. So we really need to finish this thing up at the end of April. That does not mean that we don't make changes. We will make changes based on the testing that we do. When we find errors, we find something that just doesn't make sense. It's a very aggressive time frame. That takes us really to the May through July, when you're going to see the rollout of the marketing and communications plan. We're in the process now of selecting a firm that will be really responsible for guiding us and putting together the whole marketing and communication outreach plan throughout the state. We hope to make those decisions in the next week and a half. I think we had 7 very strong proposals, could have been a little bit more than that, and we're narrowing those down as we talk. A lot of people would like to see us do a lot more education now, and I want to just assure you that we're going to do a lot of it, but we don't want to go out there too early. You know, we only have so many dollars that we can spend, and I would rather spend those when we get a little bit closer to the date than too early. We go live October of this year, 2013, and that is for what we call open enrollment, with effective coverage January 1, 2014. As soon as you go live, you turn around and you start looking at how do you retain those members that you got into that system. So it really is an iterative circle. You just don't go live and walk away from it. And the second thing is, as we develop this system, we also have what we call version 1.2, version 1.5, version 2.0, and we're actually starting now to schedule those out. You need to put those really into the queue a good 6 months to a year and a half ahead of when you decide you really want to work on them. So we're already starting to look at 2015, 2016, and how to build those capabilities into our system. Gives you kind of an estimate of our enrollment that we're projecting, and your estimate probably is as good as ours sometimes. I mean, this is really an unknown on a national basis. We look at the midpoint of about 237,000 as the objective for the first year. I shouldn't say the objective. That's where we would all kind of have just a little smile on our face. The objective is 350,000. I mean, we want to get as many people as we can. That lowers the cost on an administrative basis on a per member down a lot farther. And then the low figure is really what we call kind of the break-even. If you're down at the low end, then you have some serious discussions you need to have as a board, with the legislature, with the governor, as to the viability, because there's a point at which the administrative costs become too great to support, are too great for the kind of enrollment you have. But that gives you kind of the 3-year, what we're looking at. Those will be updated continuously. Funding overview. It really... three initial grants, what they call level one tier one, level one tier two, which is those things in level one you forgot to put in, and then a supplemental extension, which just really says if you can't spend all the money in that first little year, they give you additional time to complete those tasks. They just don't give you dollars, so it's very detailed spending plans that you have to put forth in order to get the funds. All federal grant funds, and this does not include approximately $57 or $58 million that went to the Oregon Health Authority for the IT development. This is only our funds, and I'll give some detail a little bit later. Level two, which is really the big grants that all the states are getting right now, and that will cover all development and operation costs from 2013 through 2014. Remember, they're paying all development costs plus the first full year of operations. And that takes you all the way to January 1 of 2015, when you need to be self-sufficient. The K-12 carrier and state program charges you see there starting in 14. In 2014, they will only be set at a level that allows us to get 6 months of operating reserves. We want to go into 15. You can't go in with zero in the bank. Like any business, you have to have some reserves to meet your cash flow needs. So we will have, by statute, no more than 6 months operating reserves going into 2015. Got a level two grant that we just got approved, which is $226 million. State of Washington has a level two grant that's significantly smaller than that, but they got that grant about a year ago, and they are actually going to be going back for their second level two grant. California, I think, was between $650 and $700 million. You'll notice under the total expenditures, and you look on the left side, it says IT development, operations, and maintenance. That's $96 million of that 226 is really just for the IT side. Most of that will flow through, or a good piece of it, through either OHA or Oracle, who is the third-party vendor that we are utilizing. Under contracts, you'll see that's the second largest group at $61 million. The majority of that money is marketing communications. Who is going to go out there and tell businesses what they can and can't do, what their options are? How are we going to get out to every community in the state and encourage people that don't have insurance to come in through that door? And for those that have insurance, how are we going to help them really get into this system? So really, if you took away the communications and marketing contracts and the IT piece, that is, you know, $150 million almost of the $226 million. The other major cost under this will be, and the compensation in 14 really it covers a lot of the customer service and call center that we'll be putting in place. Administrative charge. There was a lot of discussion when we were passing this legislation how we would pay for ourselves going forward in 2015 when there were no federal funds available. And I do not anticipate the federal government saying, whoops, we've changed our mind, here are some dollars. I'm taking the law for its word, which is you need to be self-sufficient going forward. How do you do that? Well, the first thing is you project the enrollment. You project the operating cost, how much it's going to take to get that enrollment and to serve it. You put those into really a straightforward formula to come up with a per member per month charge that carriers will add to their monthly premiums. An example of this, and I won't go into a lot of this detail here, but if you look at the arrow on the left, it basically says that our per member per month assessment charge on qualified health plans, that's plans offered through the exchange based on the enrollment, will be about $13.89. That's about a 2% or about 1.7% load across the market, a 4% load from what we anticipate those people coming through the exchange, the premium load for those people coming through the exchange.
Rocky, would you take about five more minutes, because I want to leave room for questions.
Sure.
I expect we'll have plenty.
So let me go to some lightning round. Communications marketing, I kind of told you what we're doing there. We've got seven or eight good proposals. Customer service, we're just starting to hire our first customer service staff and our trainers. Plan management, we have 16 carriers who have indicated interest in participating in the exchange and have filed letters of intent. 14 of those are in the individual market, 13 of those are in the small group market. I do not believe that all 16 will be there when the dust settles, but I'm hoping that, and I believe that we'll have good choices throughout the state, including not just the I-5 corridor. IT, I've talked to you a little bit about those challenges. Community partners, we're working with OHA, who have relationships with over 350 community partners. We're going to leverage that relationship that they have and ask them to assist us in really doing outreach to hard-to-reach populations. And community meetings and public input, we just got back 2 weeks ago, or last week, I guess, from Astoria and Seaside. We've been to Bend. We're starting to go out and have just public meetings. These aren't marketing. These aren't training sessions. These are really just sitting down and starting to have a little bit more in-depth discussions in some of these communities. Long-term vision, large employers. additional products. One of the things we've been hearing from both individuals and businesses is, what about life insurance? What about disability? What about long-term care? We're going to try to incorporate as much as we can the coordinated care models that we're really getting, we'll have some experience from as the transformation of the Medicaid system takes hold. Focus on quality and value as we move along. And then finally, I want to get into a position where we actually have enrollments where I can sit down and have a little bit more buying power than the zero enrollments that I have today. Sleepless in Salem, health carrier participation. Until I finally lock all those down, I will continue to worry that, again, to make sure that we have not adequate choices in Salem and Portland and Eugene, but also at Astoria and Coos Bay and Lakeview. Schedule and trade-offs. I am shut down in terms of, if anybody asks me to do anything, I have to subtract something I'm already doing. I mean, I don't have any time, so it really is managing the schedule. And every time somebody finds something that we maybe missed or that we want to add, we have to find something that we can either defer or not do. Customer service and call center, how am I going to take 20,000 calls with 150 people on the phone? Day one. That's going to be a rough ride for us when we first come out the door. Any program that's ever started has had that. We'll figure it out. Federal regulations. Just 2 weeks ago, we got another 500 pages of proposed regulations. We won't, you know, I will tell you right now, I will be asking for forgiveness, not permission, on a lot of different issues as it relates to federal regulations. Public program charges. We're working with OHA now, how we're going to handle paper applications, customer service, a variety of different functions so that we make sure that we have just one number people have to call or one address to send things, and how those costs get arrayed is going to be a very significant challenge for both sides. And finally, and I say this kind of with winking an eye, in my eye, is legislative priorities. The only thing I ask is over the next 2 or 3 months, if you change anything, change it for something after October 1, because we really are up against the wall in trying to get this to happen. The federal government said we're their Hail Mary, and meaning that there aren't a lot of states at all that are as far along as us. And what we're trying to do, especially in the integration with OHA and the exchange with Medicaid and the commercial market, is just beyond what most states are doing. Give you an example, California, you go through the exchange, you're eligible for Medicaid, not a commercial product, they send you a letter and say, call this number in your local county. They're not even integrating. So we really have, we're trying to build a Mercedes, and it's going to be a fun ride over the next 5 or 6 months. With that, I'll end it, Chair Greenlick. And
sure. And don't forget to put a motor in that. Questions?
Yes, sir. How long do we have, by the way? Are we time constrained? Because I have about six, so I'll prioritize.
Time constrained.
Okay, so
three.
This is a multi-part question. I have been told that two multi-parts.
Multiple choice.
I've been told that there are issues with the way the exchange plans to handle pediatric dental benefits, and there's some issue of non-compliance with the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. Can you explain what's going on there, what you're doing to comply, and if you aren't in compliance, are other states, or is this a common problem for exchanges? And finally, if you're not in compliance when you go live, what are you going to do?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Conger, this is a complicated issue, but I'm going to try to narrow it down. First of all, we are not alone. This is a national problem with what got into the ACA, what didn't get in, and when you bring it up to the federal government and you say, this is what we're doing, what are you doing, they just smile and they're faced with the same kind of challenges. So, best way to say this is the essential health benefits, 10 benefits that the federal government said every plan that's going to be offered through the exchange and outside the exchange for the individual and small group market has to include these benefits. And one of those benefits is pediatric dental. So you have a carrier that has to include pediatric dental.
Then you have on the other side of the ACA says, but we must allow for standalone dental plans. So you have a standalone dental carrier who comes in and says, okay, but you already got pediatric care, so you have to cut pediatric benefit out of that plan so I can offer the standalone pediatric and adult benefit in this plan. So you see the problem already is that you've got two plans on the health side, one with pediatric dental and one without. And when a person comes through the exchange, one of the first questions you have to ask is, are you going to buy family dental? And if you are, a whole set of plans comes up that doesn't include pediatric dental. If you aren't going to buy family dental, then the plans come up have pediatric dental.
So that, and let me just quickly clarify, I'm not sure I see the problem. Is it just logistical? Is it that you're complicating more of the offering, so you have to have more lines of code, or?
So we're in compliance with the intent of the federal government right there. That's the individual market. Now, they goofed on the federal side, and they said in the exchange, this is what you're going to do, but outside the exchange, you can't carve it out. So we all of a sudden are going to be doing something that the outside exchange can't do under federal law. So we're in compliance there. Where we're not in compliance is on the group side. You remember when I explained that option where you can take any carrier and any plan as an employee, option four, the defined contribution? The only way to do that is to have 15 or 16 connections with all the carriers. It isn't just a simple question of loading rates, because in the group market, your rate is set on an average census age. So if your average age is 40, you're going to pay a different rate than if your average age is 50. And it's based on the number of enrollments and what plans people take. So for the group market, it just became very complicated from a shopping experience for the client, as well as calculating the average premium for the employer to get that up and running by October 1 when open enrollment occurred. Now, if we would have known that was the way things were going to be, remember these regulations have been coming out over the last 6-7 months. We started building our shop exchange last May and June because it's so complicated
shop
with the shop. Small Employer Health Insurance Options Program. Thank you. We set that up about almost 7-8 months ago because we knew it was going to be the hardest to build. We made some assumptions that the benefit for pediatric dental was going to be very slim. And the way the feds came out on the regulations, it's not a slim benefit, it's a much larger benefit. So we really are going to look at having to wait till after we're up and running before we can begin working on bringing the pediatric dental in the same way in the group market as we're doing in the individual. Now, I will tell you, am I out of compliance with the ACA? I don't know what they are. We're going to be out of compliance with a whole bunch of things on the ACA, as are the feds. The reality is they're coming out with regulations as we speak. We don't have the time to wait for the finalization of those regulations. Now, I've committed to make this right by our first major update before we go to large groups in 2016. Now, when I say make it right, it depends on who you are, because the other carriers would like us not to carve it out, the non-standalone dental carriers. So it's just a very complicated issue, and I'd be happy to spend as much time with you offline to go through it.
Yeah, we'll take the rest of this one offline.
Should follow up on that offline. Yep. Can I ask one? This one I think is shorter. This is a qualification question. As you may or may not know, Rocky, the part of the ACA was to adjust Medicaid eligibility up to 138% of the poverty level. At what point is, and I understand you could be offering a route through the exchange to go to the CCOs, but where is the sort of interaction between the exchange subsidies and Medicaid qualification? In other words, at what point does a person become eligible for those subsidies, and are we sort of competing with the exchange plans by bringing up Medicaid eligibility levels?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, no, we're not competing because the federal law says that if you are eligible for Medicaid, you must enroll in Medicaid. You don't have the option of taking the tax credits. Or if you're eligible for the tax credits, then you obviously aren't going to be able to enroll in Medicaid. So you have to take the program that you're eligible for.
So now, all of those people will either be new enrollees,
either A, expanded, yeah.
A or B.
I should have, thank you for correcting me. You're absolutely right. We haven't expanded yet. I should be clear about that. I'm asking the question because I'm curious. Those 38%, or the additional 38%, they would all be eligible for the subsidy under the exchange if not for the expansion of Medicaid. That's probably the way I should have asked the question.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Conger, that is correct.
Okay.
It is because of the expansion taking it up to 138%.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. So my question has to do with costs. So I understand the program, how it works. It gets set up and what you've estimated as far as administrative costs. But what I don't understand is long-term, people get into this plan and they're subsidized. So is there anything besides the subsidy to make up for as a cost increase in the program so that it doesn't force people back out?
So we need to switch your name tags.
Please just answer Chair the Greenlick, questions, Rocky. Don't.
You know, I think I said this, if just getting 250,000 people insured, if 2 years from now prices go up 15-20% each year, it's not sustainable. And I think the governor and the legislature have made this plain over the last two sessions that the exchange has to be a part of a larger kind of initiative in transforming the delivery system to take better advantage of some of the quality and value standards that we need to put in place. Medicaid's kind of the laboratory to test some of that out. It's just starting. We are adopting the quality standards. I think we have 10 or 11 quality standards. The same ones that the CCOs have gone a little bit farther. I think they have another 10 or 12 that they've added, but they developed theirs after we put ours out there. We hope to bring those into greater alignment with PEB, OWEB, Medicaid, the exchange, so that we're all focused on the same kind of value, I think.
Thank you.
Rocky, will you explain very briefly, it's a complicated issue, how you're going to deal with subsidies to the premium and subsidies for the out-of-pocket expenses? That's fascinated me.
This, Chair Greenlick, this is a very complicated eligibility piece. And let me give you the best example here I can think of. A silver plan is approximately 70% of the value of the benefits you're providing. And so you have a 30% copays, deductibles, but it's a 70% benefit. However, so if you enroll in a silver plan, you get this certain premium subsidies based on that. However, if you are under 250%, there are cost-sharing subsidies that actually are, there are three levels between 250, 200, and 150, something like that. So you have reduced cost sharing depending on what your income is. So when a carrier offers just a standard silver plan, they also have to offer three additional variations depending on what someone's income is. This is why this is very complicated.
So it might say ordinarily it's a $2,500 deductible. Now it's a $1,200 deductible. And it might say it's ordinarily a 25% copay, and now it's a 17.5% copay, and you're going to have to offer these across. I mean,
that is,
you'll have to be prepared to tell somebody what they are actually going to.
But once they put in their income, those will automatically come up. So you won't get, 500 plans that you might not buy to begin with. You're going to get those plans based on your income and those cost-sharing reductions that would be available to you. And I should say that then you throw in the tribal and Alaskan Natives, and they have additional premium and cost-sharing arrangements that we have to offer for those same plans. And this is just why this is a very difficult task for from an IT perspective to put it together, as well as a communication and marketing to help people understand it.
All right. We'll take a couple more questions, but I've asked Rocky and his staff to be prepared to brief any of you in any time you have available, and he's made that about this is a very complicated business, even sitting on this oversight and cheering group, what's it called? Oversight and advocacy group. We still hear new crazy things every hour. Representative Wyden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, I mean, I got 8 billion questions on this, but just one simple one, kind of going to where you were at there. How are you going to verify someone's income? Is it going to go off their gross income, net income, and do they just input whatever income they want to, or does it have to be verifiable off of a tax statement?
Yeah, Representative Greenlick, Representative Widener. So there's a whole citizenship income verification process that's being set up, and this is, again, part of the complication. We will be using our interface with the IRS. They are the ones that provide verification of income through tax filings. And where that income is different from when you filed, you're going to have to be able to so note it and show it and provide proof of what those income changes are. That's same also on citizenship. We'll be using the national database for Homeland Security. There's a federal hub. All states will be going in and verifying citizenship or legal residence.
Last question.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up to that, what is the time frame if someone loses a job or gains a job and shifts from being Medicaid eligible to being subsidy eligible in the exchange? Mm-hmm. How quickly does that happen?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geiner, I think once you're in, you have a year. You can ask that be looked at. For example, if you are in a tax credit and lose your job, obviously that's different than when you're on Medicaid and you get a job. One of the tasks or the problems we have with this is that this is a tax credit, a refundable tax credit. So what you want to make sure people don't do is take more tax credit than they're entitled to, because at the end of the year they could end up having to pay that back. On the other hand, if they take less than what they're entitled to, while they could get the refund or the additional amounts at the end of the year, you don't want to make it so low that that they get put in a position where they aren't able to afford their premiums. But we're going to try to keep people kind of, you know, steady. I mean, one of the things about healthcare is you want it to be a background issue, not a foreground issue. You want it to be something you have and that you can count on and not have to worry about on a month-to-month basis of which program you're going to be in or out. Churning is going to be a big challenge to begin with. And to force people on a month-to-month basis because their income goes up or their income goes down to move one program to another does not make sense from a customer standpoint.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Clem, last question.
Really quickly, sorry, and we can follow up offline. Is the call center going to be staffed with Cover Oregon employees, or is it outsourced to somebody else?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Clem, so we're looking at kind of a combination. We know that we'll have to have, because we're doing call center for both Medicaid as well as the commercial side. So we're looking at about 150 employees. We're looking at perhaps 50 that will be full-time and a part of Cover Oregon, and then contract out for the additional 100. And we'll also at implementation be contracting out for what we call banks that will have pre-trained but not necessarily on anybody's payroll. So it's really a combination of contracting out and some in-house.
So if I just might make a comment, my hope is that, and we can talk about this offline, but in the various line items where you're procuring, whether it's marketing firms or consultant services or potentially these call centers, I'm hopeful that you will consider our Buy Oregon bill that we passed in 11 unanimously in the House to preference Oregon companies, or at least make it clear that you don't have to go with the lowest bidder if there's an Oregon company in your pool.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Clem, you should know that is our, we want somebody
criteria.
That calls from Gold Beach to talk to somebody who knows where Gold Beach is, okay?
Right, not Oregon.
And I'll just remind you, when Medicare was about to kick off, President Johnson was convinced that the healthcare system, the hospitals of the country, were going to be swamped. He called up the military to have it in place to deal with what was going to be the first day effect, and it turned out it wasn't really that problem. You might not get 40,000 calls
my
the first day
That's
if possible. Rocky, thank you very much. And please take advantage of Rocky's offer. Ask him to send somebody else and not him, but but please take advantage of that. This is also true of the transformation. We're not going to have enough time to really deal with these fully here, and if you have questions, make sure they get answered. I will close the informational hearing and thank Mr. King and his staff for their kind work. And let's go back to the beginning of the agenda. I think we'll skip the introductions, maybe briefly. Why don't we start down here? Introduce yourselves, and then we'll pass some rules.
Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, which is now Yamhill County and Washington County.
Representative John Lively, which is House District 12, which is essentially Springfield.
Bill Kennemer, a state representative from Canby area, and this will be my third two-year sequence.
You two flying together, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, House District 46, which includes parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland, and this is my second year on this committee.
And I'm Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, Northwest Portland, out into Washington County, and this is, I guess, my fifth term on what is this committee. Tyler?
Oh, Tyler Larson, Committee Administrator for House Healthcare.
Representative Thompson is ill today and has gone home, but he's been, he was co-chair in the last session.
He's on sick leave.
He's excused for illness today.
Yes, sir. Chris Harker from House District 34, which is Washington County, Beaverton, and Cedar Mill areas, adjacent to Chair Greenlick's district.
Jason Conger represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend, and this is my second year on this committee also.
I'm Brian Clem, and you are sitting in my district, House District 21 here in Salem.
And you're a rookie.
On this committee, yeah.
Debbie,
fourth term in the House. What, first term on this committee?
My name is Debbie Malone. I'm a committee assistant, and this is my third session.
Great. Thank you. Can we have a motion on the rules, please?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 4th, 2013.
Thank you, Representative Kenny-Geyer. Moves to adopt the rules dated February 4th, 2013. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. We have rules. Let's try and stick with them as much as we can.
It's still fine.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2092.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2092 requires Oregon Health Authority to establish and administer injury and violence prevention program and continuously appropriates monies received by gift, grant, or donation to the authority for the purpose of administering that program and declares an emergency effective on passage.
And it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, which we have approval to take off, right?
That's correct.
Great.
Wow.
Can I call, who's coming from the health authority?
Dapper.
Public health boss. It's my intention to move into a work session on this. When we finish public hearing.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Vice Chair Kenny-Geyer. I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the Director of the Public Health Division and the State Public Health Officer, and I'm here today to speak in support of this bill. This is actually a department-sponsored bill, and you do have a copy of my written testimony that's being distributed to you, as well as some letters of support. So what this bill does basically is to clarify and make explicit the legal authority for the health authority to continue to administer an existing program that we have that works on injury and violence prevention programs. It doesn't give us any new mandates or authority, and it doesn't give us any funding. It just is an unambiguous statement of support for the full range of activities that we should be doing, in my opinion, in injury prevention. We've had a program in place since 1997, and you know, it may surprise you to hear that injuries are the third leading cause of death overall in Oregon, behind only cancer and heart disease. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so important for public health to be engaged on these issues. They are also the leading cause of death among young people, Oregonians aged 1 to 44, and, of course, major contributors to health care costs as, you know, one of the major drivers of much of the transformation efforts that we're talking about a lot these days. Now, injuries aren't accidents. You know, we often use that term accidents when we talk about injuries. But, in fact, most of them are predictable, and therefore, if we can predict them, we could prevent them, at least theoretically. In 1992, CDC recognized this and established the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at CDC in Atlanta. And most health departments have similar programs in place. We have developed a very wide range of partners, some of which have sent written letters of support that you have. And also, I believe a few of them are here to testify as well today in support of the work that we do in the program. But these include trauma and acute care systems, emergency medical services, local public health, transportation, maternal and child health, school health, traffic safety, law enforcement, victim services, mental health, and occupational safety. So what we do in injury prevention is just what we do in all areas of public health, which is we try to understand and describe the problem and then use what we learn from that effort to work together with you all and other stakeholders out in the community to develop prevention programs and initiatives, and then, of course, follow back and make sure that whatever programs we put in place are doing what they're intended to do. Some of our past successes, the work we've done to protect children from bicycle injuries by promoting helmet use, support of Oregon's Safe Kids chapters, a whole host of highway safety issues we've collaborated with the Department of Transportation on, a development of a network of Tai Chi classes across the state to prevent older adult falls, and issuance of data reports on suicide, prescription drug overdose, and intimate partner violence that I think have informed policy debates in this body, as well as other places throughout the state. Very serious and costly problems. So I think we can take part of the credit for the 53% reduction in child injury that Oregon has seen since 2000, together with our partners. Of course, we don't do it alone. So if we have such a good program that's been around since 97, why do we need this bill? Well, I think it will be helpful to us to have clear and explicit support from you all for the work that we're doing, and I think a word of encouragement as well to our partners to hear that from you. In addition, this work has been supported early almost entirely with federal grants. We know we are hearing from our partners at the CDC that, in fact, the dollars available are likely to be tightening up depending on what happens with the federal budget, and I think it will help us compete for grants successfully if we have this clear statement of support from you all. So with that, I want to ask for your support and your vote on this, and I'll stop. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Will this require any new data gathering from anybody around?
There's nothing in this bill that either mandates us to do this or gives us any new authority around data gathering. Again, it's a statement of support for the work that we are already doing, this core public health work around injury prevention.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mel. I'm wondering what the cost of this program is on an annual basis, and since 97, has it kind of gone up and down? What's the trend?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, You know, I'm not sure I can quote that to you off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. It's several hundred thousand dollars that we're able to pull down from CDC for this, but we will get that information for you. I can say, in general, the program has grown since 97. We started with, I think, one staff person that we eked out some funding from various smaller grants, and we now have many more in that, but we will follow up with you on that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if I may. First would be on the violence prevention. Do you find that most of that falls under mental illness when you're dealing with this? And with the governor wanting to cut the mental illness budget, are you looking at using some of this information to establish some more finances for mental illness or help for mental ill patients?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, you know, our role in that issue would be to describe what we know. I can tell you, for example, in suicide, which is far and away the largest single group of violent deaths that we have here in Oregon, roughly about three-quarters of our violent deaths are actually suicide. Mental illness does play a very, very important role there. And you know, we put this information out and give it to the put it in the hands of the folks who are advocating around those issues, because I think it is a very, very important piece of that whole discussion. Absolutely.
Then number two is on the injury side. With you mentioned bicycle use on helmets. I've actually had some of my law enforcement officers ask for a little more, some more teeth in that law. Would you guys be supportive of that? Because right now it's a $25 fine, and if they don't pay it, nothing happens. Or they'll say, I don't have to wear a helmet because it's against my religion. That's what the kids are telling the officers, so to get out of the tickets.
They learn from their parents.
That's pretty funny.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener. With the passage of the bicycle helmet law some years ago, definitely the rate of helmet use has increased. We continue to promote that together with our partners. Certainly, increasing fines another tool that may help move things along. We have not proposed that. I don't know what the department's position would be on that, but certainly we can see what data we have on that, and if that's an area that the legislature is interested in moving, that's exactly the kind of thing where I think we can provide information that will be useful in the public policy debate about that.
Your point on that, your job's not to push policies, your job's to get
right. I may have you follow up with me on that, just because we're looking at doing something actually where they have to pay the fines before they can get their license or something like that. So
make a deposit. Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cohn, this seems like a kind of a no-brainer that's being handed to the committee here. You know, there's possibly no state cost, although the answer, I think, to the question about cost was not clear, and I think we should be asking, what does it cost the state, let alone what is the total cost of the program?
That's important. I mean, are there general funds involved in this program at all?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, we have a small amount of general fund that pays for our youth suicide prevention coordinator, but the other staff and activities are all paid for with federal grant dollars at this point.
So there is some general fund impact. You don't know the amount. I mean, I assume that there's some cost to developing the grant application, right? This is a grant process. So There's cost to the state at some point in administering this program and applying for it, but I get the impression that it's fairly minimal. And it seems like, from where I'm sitting, kind of the expectation is, well, injury prevention, violence prevention, these things are no-brainers, right? They're good programs, things that we'd like to reduce as state legislators, as citizens. But at the same time, I feel a little bit uncertain about supporting a continuation of a program where we don't have any data on whether or not it's effective. So in your testimony, and I'm throwing this out there in part because I asked OHA for more data on how you could show results for the program. And what we got was a 53% reduction in child injury. Wasn't clear to me whether that was because of the bicycle helmet program or it was beyond that. I don't know. But I guess I'm unclear about the state's role in providing Tai Chi classes. I wouldn't say that intuitively strikes me as an appropriate role for the state to spend money on, regardless of where it comes from. You could take the perspective that it's coming out of somebody's pocket somewhere, or it's being borrowed, or you could say that it's being used to give Tai Chi classes instead of doing something else that's worthwhile. And so what I'm asking you, and if you can't deliver it today, I understand completely, but I would like to follow up. Is this program effective at doing something? Are we just spending money because it sounds good, or are we actually making a difference by expending these dollars? And are they being spent prudently and effectively to do what people expect from us, which is, if we're going to support something and if we're going to spend their money on something, it actually does what it's supposed to do?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Conger, I'd be happy to follow up with you on that. I think we have actually quite an impressive record of accomplishments. And I should clarify on the Tai Chi issue. This program does not pay for Tai Chi classes for all of the folks in the state. What we were involved in was developing the network for that. We did some of the initial research demonstrating that this was an effective way to reduce falls in older adults, and then pulling together and working with a group of partners who have then gone on to develop and offer those services to folks as they've seen fit to do around the state. But I will be happy to have some more discussion with you about that. I think there's a lot that I can point to that I think is successful about this program.
And I would appreciate that. I was throwing that out as an example, and I apologize. I should have read that more carefully, because it does say develop a network. And the point really wasn't to digress onto the Tai Chi or the specifics of how you're achieving the goal. It's a question of whether or not we're actually achieving the goal. Do we have a goal? Are we measuring our progress? And I don't mean to sound adversarial. I did ask for this information to be provided at this hearing, not to you, but to somewhat at OHA. And obviously the word didn't get around, but I think it's an important, for me as a legislator, it's important to know that we're not just doing it because the title sounds good or the program sounds good. And if it's been around for a while, let's see if it's actually succeeding. That was the point I was trying to make. So if you'd follow up with me, I'd really appreciate it.
Happy to do that.
Thank you, Doctor. Can I call Aaron Greenwald, Patty O'Sullivan, and Sybil Webb, please? You may want to hang in case somebody else comes up. Okay, who's going to start?
Thank you, Representative and Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Erin Greenwald. I'm an attorney at the Department of Justice. Specifically, I'm the Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor for the Department of Justice, and I've been in that position for 3 years. Prior to that, I was a Domestic Violence Prosecutor in Marion and Yantel counties for 11 years. And I am here to encourage your support of House Bill 2092. I provided copies of my testimony that's, I think, being distributed to you currently. As a domestic violence resource prosecutor, I work with a number of allied professionals throughout the state who work within the criminal justice system as it relates to domestic violence issues. One of the duties of my job is to co-chair with Erin Kelly Seal, who is the director of the Department of Human Services, the statewide domestic violence fatality review team. The legislature gave authority in 2005 to create that team. However, it wasn't until 2010 when we actually got to work part of the impetus in going forward during that year was that in 2010, we saw a dramatic spike in the number of intimate partner and family violence-related deaths. On average each year, between 20 to 25% of all violent deaths are related to domestic violence. In 2010, that went up to 30%. And I guess I would footnote that by saying that those statistics come from the Oregon Health Authority. Those are valuable statistics that we use to move forward important policy and legislative positions. And their definition of intimate partner violence is a much narrower one than we in the criminal justice system use. I make that notation to the committee because if you were to expand the definition of the deaths that we're looking at, the number and the percentage of deaths overall related to domestic and family violence would increase significantly. It's a huge, huge problem. OHA has been a critical partner in the statewide fatality review team. It has several key members of its staff who are on the fatality review team. Additionally, research by OHA experts, of which there are many, have significantly contributed to the team's efforts. And in the first case review, the team identified several key areas where OHA's injury and prevention program could significantly and positively impact the deterrence of DV-related homicides in our state. I would say in my position as a statewide resource going across the state, I have seen where OHA in its unique position as the primary resource in Oregon for state injury data collection is invaluable. Its ability to focus that particular expertise on the area of intimate partner and family violence is absolutely critical. I'm sure this House specifically is aware of the epidemic of domestic violence that we have had in this state. In about a decade, this state has seen over 206 members of its community lost to domestic violence. In addition to the amazingly and staggering amount of adverse effects on our community because of domestic violence, and OHA does some really critical research and policy and data collection when it comes to that point. I guess I would close by saying, as OHA did in a CD summary that it put out in December, addressing the cycle of family violence requires a multi-sector, systemic, and life course approach. We need to prevent violence before it starts, prevent recurrence after an episode, address the adverse health effects themselves, and prevent the cycle of violence from continuing to the next generation. Thank you.
Patty?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I'm here today to testify on this bill. The prevention program, we're completely and utterly very supportive of this program. It does many great things, as you can hear and read from your testimony. So I'm not here really to talk about the program itself. We're very supportive. I understand that the language in this bill codifies what currently is being done, which makes sense. You need to have authority and statute to do what you're doing. So I am here, though, to talk a little bit about data, and more specifically data collection. And Dr. Cohn and I talked this morning, and I've been talking to his staff for a few days now, about our concern with this bill that while it codifies what they're currently doing, if the naked eye looks at the language in the bill, it gives them authority to collect data. And our concern is not with Dr. Cohn and his current staff, but with having on the record that doesn't really mean any new data collection. And so we've agreed among ourselves to work on that on the Senate side. And if you want to pass it out today, we're very supportive of that. We will be asking for and working with the department on an amendment to be sure that we're talking about current programs. And that, for instance, a traumatic brain injury, there was a bill last session for traumatic brain injury registry. It didn't pass. past. It all went away. I don't want somebody looking at this 4 years from now and saying, oh, look, we have the authority to collect whatever data we want. Let's start a new traumatic brain injury registry. We currently, our hospitals currently submit a lot of data to a lot of people on a lot of issues. And we're supportive of that. As Representative Conger says, you know, when we see the outcomes, we don't mind giving you the data. What are you going to do with it, and what is it going to show us so that we can have better health and prevention of accidents for folks? The department has done that, and we are very supportive of this program. But again, we'd like some sideboards on it to make sure that when looking at this new statute, that that doesn't mean that we're now going to have to submit some new set of data that we currently aren't. We're working with Senator Bates. We've worked in the interim very closely with Senator Bates on his STEMI and stroke and lots of data systems and where is this data and are we duplicating data? And so we're working on those issues because it's very expensive and time-consuming and labor-intensive to enter data and collect data at our end for everybody that passes through our hospitals. So, again, I know it sounds like I'm not supportive, but I am supportive of this, and we are going to work with the department on an amendment. I just want to make that very clear and have it on the record. And so we are very supportive of passing this today over to the Senate to do a little bit of additional work.
Great.
Chair Green, like members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today, also in support of House Bill 2092. I wanted to speak on the Law Center's behalf because as a provider of civil legal services to low-income people, our mission is to help people overcome barriers to escaping poverty and help them to access justice. A significant portion of our clients are coming to us because they are suffering from the effects of domestic and sexual violence. Child abuse is also a significant factor. And as such, we have started to take a closer look over the past number of years to how we can be a part of a better coordinated community response and to develop partnerships to provide people with greater access to prevention and safety resources. And we've been really pleased to be able to be a partner with OHA in many different respects over the years and see that it has made a big difference for our clients. One example is that some of the data that we've become aware of is that there's a significant incidence of child abuse within domestic violence relationships or in homes where domestic violence is present. And that has caused danger to children, obviously. And we have the Department of Human Services providing support and resources response to children. We have been able to develop through partnerships and through a greater awareness of that problem, also support and safety services for parents who are victims so that we can more quickly resolve those safety concerns and more safely and quickly return children home to their protective parents. And we think that's having a major impact on the lives of children and on victims. And it's also something that we hope to move forward through future years and more fully fund so that we can make our state responses more efficient as well and make a better use of resources. The only other information I'd like to specifically point out is that we've learned through data that's been provided to us by OHA and also that it's consistent with some national statistics that the impact of domestic violence on children and teens living in homes where that's present is significant and is far greater than I had realized. It has impact on mental health instances, on readiness to learn, on physical injury rates, of course, but also on substance abuse and depression rates. And so if we can learn more about what that looks like so as to better target our state resources and our response, I think that's a wonderful way for the state to move. So we appreciate OHA's efforts on that respect.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. I'm sorry. Do you have a question?
I did, but...
No, it's fine.
Okay. Just because we have an attorney up here, this would be for you, Aaron. Of the 30% of all the homicides, what percentage of those would you say were suffering from mental illness?
I could not say, sir, and I don't know that there is data. Let me back up. Representative Byers, Chair Greenlick. The OHA does, through their violent death reporting systems and their injury and prevention plan programs, intimate partner violence reports. And most recently, they came out with a 7-year review, and then annually they come out with a review of the year before. And so we get statistics about the number of violent deaths, and of those deaths, the numbers associated with intimate partner violence. Of those, we don't know what's caused by mental health. But what I will say as to your question, and it brings up a point that I wanted to make, I heard Dr. Cohn say during his testimony that a vast majority of the violent deaths that we suffer in Oregon are those suicides. What we don't know, and what I think would be interesting for us to understand, is what percentage of those suicides are caused by mental illness, and what percentage of those are caused or related to domestic or intimate partner violence, because anecdotally and through my experience, I believe that the percentage of those would be very high, and of course, some of those would be probably coexisting between mental health and domestic violence as well. But in short, sir, I don't know the answer to your question.
I've asked Dr. Cohn to do an informational hearing for us on the violent death information sometime in the next few weeks, so we'll have a better chance of looking.
The reason I bring it up, Mr. Chair, is I think we'll find mental illness takes a big role in a lot of this, and we don't require patients to take their medication in this state, and we have a lot of people out on the streets that aren't medicating or even in the hospitals with no recommendation for them to take it. It's take it if they want to or not.
Well, let's save
and
that
I think
for
this is a
day,
big issue that needs to be addressed. So I don't know if I'm into studying any more per se, but I think we need to start acting on some of the studies that are out there.
Thank you. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2092 and open a work session on House Bill 2092. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2092 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves House Bill 2092 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. There's a zero Ways and Means impact, fiscal impact on this, and the Speaker has authorized this motion. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just, I want to be supportive of this program if it is successful and it is working. And none of the testimony today would suggest that this is not a good program, but I wasn't very clear on exactly where it fits into our whole response to things like domestic violence and our whole data collection effort as a state, and whether or not it is very successful in deploying those resources. Now, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I feel like I would be more comfortable voting on this bill if I had access to the answers to those questions. And I don't think that this is an issue that requires an enormous amount of debate or consideration. But we heard from a little bit of the testimony that at a minimum it needs there's some feeling that the bill needs to be amended. I'm not sure what the rush is to move it through, but my preference would be to be more thoughtful about it, to allow the bill to be amended in our committee where we can weigh in on it as a group, and then move it on, rather than depend on the Senate or some subsequent amendment process.
Mr. Widener, is it Kenmer?
I would have to go with Representative Conger here. I would rather us amend it here before we send it to the Senate and rely on them to do it. I mean, their first day we're in here, actually first chance I've got a chance to actually go through this. And there's some stuff I would like to check out further before we move this or push this bill any further as well.
Who else is he down there? Is it Kenmer?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my view is that this program has been in existence for a considerable period of time, and I guess I would reflect also on the letter that was provided from Harvard School of Public Health, where it says, Oregon Health Authority's Public Health Division has been a leader in the nation in collecting data on injuries that harm its state's population and using that data to inform prevention programs and guide policies. And I guess in my experience, which is limited in this matter, but I think that is an accurate statement, and I'm comfortable with the bill. I do like the idea of amending bills in the originating committee. On the other hand, some of these things come up at the last minute, and as long as there's a commitment to make sure, I think that plot provides the guarantee that makes me comfortable.
Senator Harper?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had not asked to speak, but I am impressed by the testimony that we've received. I think you referred to at one point as seeming to be a slam dunk or something that's been handed to us easily.
I said no-brainer.
No-brainer, thank you. Just wanted to get you on the record saying that again.
So to speak.
No-brainer. I think the testimony that we've received, the written testimony that we've received from obscure schools like Harvard and as well as elsewhere, have me comfortable taking a vote on this point.
Yes. If I can, just a silly anecdotal comment. It's interesting to me, having had a very serious ladder accident a couple of years ago, you know, and reading thereafter that the number one cause of death among men over 60, accidental cause of death, is ladders. That is an informing item, and my wife
first.
Was out yelling at me considerably as I put up the Christmas lights this December. So just to say, I think data sometimes is informing, not always successful, but informing.
I just like to say I'm very familiar with this program. I've watched it. I've used the data for a long time. It is a successful program. I think there's I can put on the record that there, for the legislative intent, that there's no intent to increase any data collection process. I frankly think the amendment is unnecessary, but if it's amended in the Senate and comes back to us that way, I'd certainly accept the amendment. But it just seems an obvious program. We've got 69 bills to deal with. I don't think waiting on a bill that, in fact, is a no-brainer really makes a lot of sense. I would urge Dr. Cohn to get both to Representative Conger and to Representative Widener to brief them further before it gets to the floor so they'll feel more comfortable whichever way they decide to vote on the floor, or anybody else that would like that. That briefing, I think it would be useful. So I will close the debate and ask for a roll call, please.
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
No.
Representative Harper?
Aye.
Representative Kramer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Representative Thompson.
And Representative Thompson.
Excuse. I vote aye. Motion passed. Representative Lively, how about you carrying this one on the floor?
I'd be glad to.
Close the work session on House Bill 2092 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2089. I think we have amendments coming on 2100. Holly, would be any problem to you coming back on Wednesday if we carry it over? Good. Well, we'll let you know in advance. We'll carry over House Bill 2100, waiting for an amendment. Mr. Gallagher, is that? I see him back there. And he'll be in the building. I'm sure we'll be able to find him on Wednesday. Please,
right
go
in
ahead.
The middle there.
Where?
Right on the aisle, just to the left, standing up.
Are you shaking your head? Is Wednesday okay with you?
I love Wednesday.
Good. Thank you. James? Who's first?
I'll go first. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Suzanne Hoffman. I'm a chief operating officer for the Oregon Health Authority. And I'll just open with a little bit of an introductory statement, probably turn it over to my colleague, Jim Scherzinger, to answer any questions and go through detail. I have a cold. I'm going to try to talk as little as possible so I don't cough into your microphone. In 2009, for a little context, House Bill 2009 established the Oregon Health Authority, separate from the Department of Human Services. The legislation consolidated addictions and mental health, public health, medical assistance programs, the Office of Private Health Partnerships, the Office of Health Policy and Research, the Public Employees Benefit Board, and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, all within OHA. In 2011, House Bill 2100 made some statutory changes to reflect the creation of the OHA. And this bill, House Bill 2089, makes some additional clarifications relating to the creation of OHA and specifically to its relationship with the Department of Human Services. As you may recall, as one larger DHS became two agencies, DHS and OHA, we agreed in order to maintain efficiencies and to continue to operate well together in partnership for all of those that we serve, to share those back office administrative functions, things like human resources, things like information technology, our financial services are very integrated and tied together. And we jointly govern those processes between the two agencies to work in partnership. So a lot of this clarification is just correcting some oversights in the early legislation to enable us to continue to do that.
I'm Jim Scherzinger. I'm the Chief Operating Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Scherzinger, Chief Operating Officer for the Department of Human Services. And as Suzanne said, this bill relates entirely to the division of duties amongst DHS and OHA. And these are issues that were created when the agencies were split and were somehow, in one way or another, the division of duties wasn't done correctly.
613-page bill didn't
right,
do it. Huh?
Right. And actually, we've been through this once before last time, and now hopefully this is the last time. And we have a few items left to deal with. And that's essentially what this bill is. So it's a housekeeping bill. It has no cost. If anything, it would help us save money because we can operate more efficiently because of the changes in the bill. As the summary points out, I mean, the kinds of things that it does is, for example, allows OHA or DHS to be represented at contested case hearings by the officer of either one. As you may know, a lot of the eligibility work for OHA is done by DHS, and so we could get in contested case hearings that could involve activities by one by either employee of OHA or DHS. And this allows, when it goes to a contested case, to have either DHS and OHA. We thought we were going to be able to do that under the way the original bill was working, but we got a DOJ's opinion that said, no, you have to have an OHA employee there for an OHA case and a DHS for DHS. This is just allowing us to go back the way we did it when we are one department and just have an employee for either one there that's qualified to do the work. There's a number of other things in the bill that are of that ilk. Perhaps the major one is at the very end, which says that, generally speaking, allows the one department to delegate to the other specific duties that for the good or for the efficient operations of the system, that one department can delegate duties to the other one. And I think it's a reflection of how integrated we still are and we try to be. When the OHA was created, the legislature was very clear that we were not to increase administrative costs as a result of that, which typically happens when you split agencies and give them all separate functions. And we've been as diligent as we can to try to not increase administrative costs and to share functions. And this is essentially going to do that. There's one other piece that's in the bill that deals with the Department of Human Services authority to take over a county DD program when the county no longer wants to give it up. That is a result of an error in the last bill that passed that tried to do this. The legislature had passed a bill that allowed the Department of Human Services to do that on a permanent basis as opposed to temporarily. That was a separate bill that passed in the last legislative session, and when the cleanup bill went through, it unfortunately moved the law back to the way it was before by accident, and it wasn't picked up in conflict amendments, which normally that's where you would pick up. And so this bill is now correcting that mistake in the last bill. So that's the high-level view of what's in the bill. We'd be glad to address any questions.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if my computer is updated, but on page 4, line 40, and in other spots, it's dealing with prescription drugs. Is that correct? So authority may not purchase prescription drugs directly or indirectly through the program for recipients? House Bill 2089?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, yes, my understanding is that's not actually a change, but simply a clarification in the language that the Medicaid agency cannot purchase directly from the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. There is an Oregon Health Plan pharmaceutical program that is separate from that. So this is not a change, but simply clarifying language.
Well, it's in dark black, and it goes on in different spots. There's a whole bunch on prescription drugs in here.
Well, I see Gardner, and we'll hear from him in a minute, but basically what's been going on is the legislative councils have been changing the wording to put it in the current style rather than the past one. I think that's the same thing. But let's hold this question in. Mr. Gardner is going to be testifying in a moment. I think he'll have more to say about that.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have, in addition, Mr. Mullen and Mr. Gardner. Then let's start with you. Maybe you can clarify whether we have a problem here or not.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for PhRMA. PhRMA is the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, which is the trade association for the major research-based drug manufacturers. This is language in... on page 4, lines 39 through 42, that actually Tom Burns of OHA and I have worked on last session. It was embodied in a piece of legislation that hit a snafu in the second house, but it's actually a very important language. And what it does, the way the law is currently written, it says that the agency... that receives federal Medicaid funds, which is OHA, may not participate in the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, which is the bulk purchasing aggregate negotiating program, the agency. And the unintended effect of that is that it disallows OHA to participate on behalf of OEB, for example, because it's the entire agency that is disallowed. The intent of that provision is to take out the Medicaid program, and there are a couple of reasons why for that, which I can go into in detail if you like, but this language simply restricts the carve out to the Medicaid purchases and thus allows OPDP to partner with OEB, for instance, which is an OHA entity, to participate in the program. We tried to do it last session, but the bill foundered on for some unknown reason.
It puts in place what was intended to be
exactly so.
Can I follow up with a question?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just explain to me what the reason for the carve-out for Medicaid?
Yes. There's basically two reasons. The first is that by federal law, the Medicaid purchases already are mandated to receive best price. And second, there's a line of court decisions that says you cannot use the Medicaid population to essentially leverage additional price benefits for non-Medicaid recipients.
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. Ms. Hoffman and Mr. Scherzinger went over the history of how we got here, and I just want to add a couple of things to that and raise a couple of issues for the moment. When House Bill 2009 was passed, a number of us were looking at the issues that exist between DHS and the Oregon Health Authority. And then after the bill was passed, a big chunk of eligibility determination was moved from the Department of Human Services to the Oregon Health Authority. Now, what House Bill 2009 did was it maintained the Oregon Health Authority as the Medicaid authority. We certainly didn't have a problem with that. And in fact, we don't have a problem with the bill except for the fact that eligibility functions are not spelled out in statute pertaining both to DHS and the Oregon Health Authority. We have some issues that relate to eligibility in and of itself, but also contested hearings and finally language issues. Now, the reason that I wanted to be here today is that I wanted to bring these issues up. I have been working with the Oregon Health Authority on this discussion. They have been very cooperative and helpful, interested at the same time to get a relatively uncomplicated bill, fixed bill, through. So I just wanted to draw this to the attention of the committee today and continue to work with the Oregon Health Authority. For our attorneys around the state, they're concerned that, particularly in contested hearings, that they have the appropriate standing, and if it's not in statute, is specifically called out. There's a concern about that. So, but we continue to work with the Oregon Health Authority, and if we can reach agreement, we would be happy to support the bill. But meanwhile, we continue to have questions.
I'm not sure I understand. You have another bill coming, is that what you're saying? Or you have a problem with this bill? Not because of what's not in it, but because of something that is in it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the concern with this bill is the things that are not in it, that we have worked with the department on, suggested language, suggested changes. There is concern on the part of the department about, again, keeping this bill relatively simple and establishing enough in the way of a public record to establish that there's not an issue about somebody who's been brought into the system eligibility. Their eligibility has been determined by the Oregon Health Authority, but the function of eligibility not being specifically delineated in current ORSs. So it's really, it's kind of a technical issue at that, but at the same time, we're committed to continue to work with the department to see if we can make sure and make clear the fact that a client is not going to be adversely impacted when it comes time for a hearing and or it goes to court and the statutes don't spell out the eligibility responsibilities clearly for the Oregon Health Authority.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, John. The, you know, I see this bill as really one of trying to align OHA and DHS and not cause duplicative services. So I'm wondering if your concerns are would be properly addressed by an amendment in this bill or whether it actually really belongs somewhere else. I'm trying to get the connection about the eligibility question with how DHS and OHA work well together, which is the primary intent of this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, that was our interest. We've been working with the department on this for some time to try to get the kind of clarification that we're looking for. If it doesn't require an amendment, we would be fine with it as long as our attorneys feel that they have the standing that they need mm-hmm. when these eligibility issues arise.
All right. I think you said it's okay to move ahead with this and you'll keep working with OHA.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's not my interest to hold up this bill. On the other hand, if we don't have satisfactory discussion about resolving these issues, I'd be taking it up on the Senate side.
Oh, well, I'd be committed to help you create a new bill if that's what it is you need. But it seems to me the issues are really clear that are in this bill. So I'm, You don't usually confuse me, John.
Well,
you have
Mr. Chair,
Jim always tries to confuse me.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm sorry for any confusion, but just in the main, just to circle around just very quickly again about this, when House Bill 2009 was passed, it did not create the authority for the Oregon Health Authority to do eligibility functions. The processing center, which is known as 5503, that's been moved over to the Oregon Health Authority. So mainly, we just want to be sure that there are the proper kind of consumer protections in this bill. And if there's not, and I may, Mr. Chair, take you up on the opportunity to look at a separate bill on this
issue. It would seem to me that could use a separate bill, and I'd be happy to use one of my priorities to make it happen.
And we have developed language about that, and I'll work with you and your staff on that.
Okay. All right. I'll close the public hearing and open up a work session on House Bill 2089.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2089 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves House Bill 2089 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Harker?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Wiley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Excused.
And Chair
Greenwood. Aye. Motion passes. House Bill 2089. We're going to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Anybody want to carry it? Madam Vice Chair, will you be so kind as to carry it?
I will.
Okay. Hey, we're finished 5 minutes early. Maybe we can bring Rocky King back.
It was lively again.
Did you want to do this, Elsie?
Oh,
this one's here. Elsie.
I'm sorry. Oh, that's right. Hold on. We have an LC to introduce as a committee bill. You have that LC with you. It modifies and denies licensure requirements for professionals regulated by the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists. Do I have a motion to adopt that as a committee bill? Introduce as a committee bill?
Chair Greenlick, I move that the following legislative concept be introduced as a committee bill. LC 3036 dated
1/15/2013. LC number. Right. Representative Kenny Geyer moves that LC 3036, dated 1/15/13, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Just a reminder, we don't endorse the bill by introducing it as a committee bill. It is just introduced as a committee bill. Is there any dissent? Any problems? So unless there's business, more business to be brought before the committee, we are adjourned.
Get your signature on that.